Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You might know my guest on this week's show from Happy Endings, The Mindy Project, or the most bonkers train wreck in late-night TV history.
One of my favorite movies, Ben, is this movie called Bangkok Dangerous that Nicolas Cage is in.
It's a real film?
It's a real movie, and Nicolas Cage is in it, and there's like a five-minute scene where he's out on a date with a deaf girl, and they're eating soup in Thailand, and he tries the soup, and for like 5 minutes, he keeps going like this, like, "It's hot. Soup is hot. The soup, it's hot. Steam. The soup is hot."
Yeah. Do it for the full
steam,
5 minutes.
It's like a hot steam. It's too hot to drink.
Commit for the full 5 minutes.
Too hot to drink. And then finally, the deaf girl like reaches for the soup, and he goes, no. It's too hot.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and that was Adam Pally guest hosting The Late Late Show on CBS back in 2015. If you listen to our episode with Ben Schwartz, who was Adam's sidekick on that January night in the middle of a New York blizzard, you know that I'm kind of obsessed with his off-the-rails comedy performance that has only become more legendary as the years go by. But that is just one of many reasons why I wanted to have Adam on this podcast. Another is that his really funny show, Champagne Ill, just recently started streaming on Hulu after it kind of came and went without much fanfare on YouTube a few years back. Then there's his major role behind the scenes of one of my favorite political comedy shows of the past few years, The President Show. Adam was not only an executive producer, but also came through with an inspired Donald Trump Jr. impression. More on that later. He's just an all-around hilarious actor and improviser, and I'm so happy to have him on the show today. Here's me with Adam Pally.
Thanks for doing this, and I'm glad you could make some time on moving day.
Yes, no, and thank you again for having me. And if you hear, if I'm holding the mic too close and you hear me like Tony Soprano nose breathing, or you hear like strips of tape being like ripped, I apologize.
I'm sure it'll be fine. Well, welcome. I have to tell you, I had not seen Champagne Ill the first time around when it came out on YouTube, but I just watched the entire thing over the past few days on Hulu, and I loved it. And I was like, I don't know what I was thinking. I missed it.
Oh no, it's not your fault at all. There's so much good television. How could anyone find everything?
Yeah.
You know, it would be impossible. But it's been a bit of a bit of time since we made it.
Yeah, does it feel weird to be like promoting something that you in another world?
It definitely feels weird to be promoting something that I made like way pre-COVID. But at the same time, like there's no rules anymore for like how TV works, how movies work, how things are found or not found. And I'm really proud of the show. So if this is what it takes to like get it a second life, then whatever, you know, I enjoy talking about it because I really love it.
Yeah. So it started as a YouTube original, which I didn't quite know what that was. And now it's on Hulu.
Yeah. I don't really know what a YouTube original is either.
Can you explain the premise for anyone who hasn't gotten a chance to see it yet? Because it has a very specific premise.
Well, you would hope that most shows have a specific premise. The premise is about like a very, very successful and famous rapper who kind of after high school takes his two buddies and rides to the top and is living that insane lifestyle. And in one of his video shoots, the famous rapper dies, and it leaves the two best friends without an education or really even a driver's license. So they have to start from scratch again in their hometown.
How you guys holding up?
Shitty.
Super fucking shitty, Craig.
Yeah. So the funeral is tomorrow back in Champagne. Oh.
Funeral.
I didn't even think we're gonna have to do that, right? So you know what? Just tell the plane we'll be wheels up around 3 or 4.
And as far as like lunch goes on the plane, just, you know, whatever's easiest.
Yeah, we don't want to put anybody out.
Well, there's not gonna be any lunch on the plane.
Right. Right, of course. Because if we're leaving around 4, that's that weird no man's land between lunch and dinner.
Yeah, it's a bit of a tweener.
I can't even eat right now. I'm so sad.
No. There's not going to be lunch on the plane because there is no plane. The label chartered the plane for Lou's tour, so now that Lou is...
Oh, shit. That's right. I'm sorry. I mean, I guess we'd be fine flying commercial.
Our main concern is getting home as fast as we can to be with Lou's family. So even if we can't fly first, you know, coach is fine. I mean, not coach, obviously. What's the other kind of...
Business.
Business. Right, so just to recap, first option would be aisle first, second option would be window first, and then third option, I guess...
Maybe like a couple of rows each of coach could feel like first?
Yeah. Not coach again. What is it called?
Business.
Business, right. I think I have grief brain. Is that a thing? Craig, could you Google grief brain?
Yeah, so you and Sam Richardson play the two friends, and then you have Jay Farrow, who's kind of... that's... you kind of have a good trick there, because he seems like a pretty big name to die in the first episode.
Yeah, Jay is one of the funniest, most talented dudes on the planet, and did us a huge favor by coming in. And he comes back a couple times throughout the season, but
incredibly believable as a famous rapper too.
He's so good. Yes, of course, he's so good. I mean, that is really him singing and him rapping in the show. And he worked...
no, the
with
song's the, great. The main...
thank
the main
you. He worked
song,
with
yeah.
PJ Morton from Maroon 5, had he chosen to do something else, he could have done that too.
It's kind of, you know, the show is a little bit in the world of like, what if Vince from Entourage died and what would happen to the people around
totally.
Him? I know you have
a
special love-hate relationship with that show. Was that on your mind at all when you were working on this show?
I wouldn't say love-hate. I appreciate that show. You know, like, you know, Entourage is like a fabric of my growing up. A little bit like you know, I think a lot of young men, they like watch that show, and Hollywood became obsessed with this term of like wish fulfillment, like living out the lives of, you know, regular people in Hollywood. And I don't know, there was something about that show that just struck a chord in me. And so we always thought like, oh, this is kind of a version of that. But if there was no money left and there was no...
A lot of that show is like, yeah, wish fulfillment, best case scenario. This show is like worst case scenario for these people.
Yes. It's actually like, it's super interesting. It's like, I'm sure there's some socioeconomic paper to be written about Entourage and the time it was created in Champagne Hill and the time it was created where like, you know, when Entourage is created, the general public wants to live through the eyes of a rich and famous person. And then at the time that this is created, all the people in the general public kind of feel like they are movie stars. So they actually want to see what happens if it goes wrong, which is actually like, there is a paper to be written there. I certainly won't think about it again after this sentence, but...
Yeah, I mean, your character and Sam's character are very much like, they kind of think that they're famous, but they're not, or they were adjacent to fame, and then it went away. So did you think at all about your relationship to fame in this and how, you know, you live in this, world where you have a pretty perfect level of fame. And I think I've heard other people talk about this where, you know, you're maybe not in the tabloids every day, but you get the good perks. So do you think about that at all in terms of what level of fame is actually ideal before it turns into a disaster?
What are the perks you speak of?
Oh yeah. Well, maybe there are none. You could tell me.
I'd love to know. No, there are definitely perks of fame. I would love to know the perks of fame that you would assume that I would get, because I haven't really found those yet. Like, I can't call up a restaurant and be like, my name is Adam Pally. I'd like table for two. They'd be like, well, my name is Gary, and no, you know, like that doesn't... I don't know if that ever really flies. Also, I'm not the type of person I think that would ever do that. But to answer your question, yes. I think it made Sam and I definitely think about our fame a little bit, for sure, at the time. I don't want to sound like prestigious, like, oh, I don't live in Hollywood, but, you know, like I did for many years, and I'm sure I will again. But there is something nice about living outside of Los Angeles, outside of like the the kind of all-consuming entertainment industry that keeps you from like reaching that level of tabloid fame. Like, neither Sam and I have like dated a celebrity or like, you know, I think there are certain things that bump you up into that level that
I feel like Sam's like making a play for action star now. So I don't know. He might be getting there.
Sam can do whatever he wants to do. Sam is one of the most talented.
He really is.
Humans I've ever come across. He also plays bass and loves ska.
I don't mean to put him on blast
like that, but, no, Sam's career is literally wide open. He can do whatever he. I mean, I was telling someone like Sam is going to direct one day, and I just from working with him on Champagne Ale, like so much of Champagne Ale was the two of us like learning from each other and the different things that we've come up doing, and you know he's got a really great career ahead of him.
Yeah,
and behind him.
Did moving to New York, you know, change your life significantly in these ways where you weren't thinking as much about the industry or you felt like you could kind of step away a little bit?
Yeah, totally. I think naturally it does. You know, in some ways you think more about stuff than you did there, and in some ways you think less. And I think like that give or take was I needed at the time, where it was like the things I was thinking more about were not necessarily the things that get you where you want to be. You know, they're like you know what I mean? Like I needed to think more about like the actual things that I was creating and doing. And I think you can become obsessed with that in New York because you are like right outside of this like Hollywood nexus. So you become obsessed with like, well, what's the thing that I'm going to do next? As opposed to like sometimes when you're there, you become obsessed with like, well, what's the thing that like will get me going? It's like, you know, not necessarily an organic way to think.
Yeah. I mean, I know you started, you know, it at UCB. Was that in New York that you started or in LA?
Yeah,
when you?
I started it in UCB, New York. Yeah.
And that was like almost 20 years ago. So, I mean, what were your,
put me on blast. I guess I deserve that, man. I deserve that.
What were your aspirations then when you were just starting out at UCB in terms of what you wanted to do in this comedy world?
I don't know if I had I don't know if I had aspirations. I mean, I think like, you know, like everybody, like, you know, I wanted to be on Saturday Night Live or write on Saturday Night Live or work for the Daily Show, or, you know, like there are only so many jobs you could have coming up in New York. And you first get to the UCB and you're like, I don't know, I'm just learning. And then very quickly you're like, whoa, it's attainable. Like there's a wealth of talent that I was lucky enough to be around at that time to like see every night and learn a craft from every night. And there are names that, you know, are huge. There are names that you see every day on screen, right? And commercials and, you know,
some of the funniest people who may not be the most famous.
Yeah, and then some of the not funniest people who are famous. It's like, it didn't matter.
So, I mean, you said, you know, SNL and The Daily Show, were those like opportunities that were coming your way in terms
of
auditions?
Sure, yeah,
I
bombed so many Daily Show auditions. Yeah, I mean, you know, I had a couple that were interesting, and I didn't understand the assignment, I guess, if for the SNL audition. You know, I mean, I've had a
meaning
a
you
long,
didn't do what they you didn't do what they were looking for, or you
I just like did my own version of it and it didn't come across correct. You know, I think now it would have been better received. But
they seem
to
be taking more chances in recent years, maybe, than they were then.
They're always great. I can't criticize.
I'm just saying, I'm more in it as a plus of the people they're taking. Even these, like this season, they took some people who are pretty out there in their comedy. I think
that's cyclical. I think SNL always, it's the top tier of talent. Even, you know, whether you make it or not on the show, you have something to be tapped.
What do you feel like was the first really big thing that you got that changed things for you? Was it Happy Endings or something before that? Or
the first big thing I got that changed things for me? It's also foggy. I booked my first movie. It was interesting. I was edited out of most of it. I made it a little bit, but my first movie was for Ang Lee and is called Taking Woodstock.
I think there are a lot of comedians in that movie.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think there are two looking back.
So, I don't Dimitri remember. Martin, right?
Well, Dimitri was the lead. Yeah. And Eugene Levy was in it. Or Levy. Never get that right. Sorry, Dan. I'm trying to think who were the other comedians, but like, yeah, so that was my first, thing that I ever like booked. And I was kind of a surprise to book it. It was at this casting office, but that was run by A.V. Kaufman, who's kind of a legend in the New York biz. And Emile Hirsch, a lot of my scenes were supposed to be with Emile Hirsch. And it was supposed to go, that role was supposed to go to like a younger, cooler actor, you know? But I looked a lot like the real guy. So, and I did a good job in my audition, but it was dramatic, most of it. But Ang Lee...
Was that weird to sort of book your first movie as a drama after doing so much comedy?
It was, but honestly, at the time, the UCB was such a place that you went to cast. Like, and I was a little older, so I was already like on what would be considered like the main stage and doing more like interesting improv work. Like some of my later work in improv, especially once I found a group of like like-minded people and I was on stage like every Saturday night as like the main show at the theater, I think some of my work became more dramatic, became better acted, became more dramatic, became less jokey. And so it wouldn't be a shock, you know, it would like happen all the time. Some director would see someone do an improv show and be like, I want this guy to play this. And I think I looked a lot like the guy. And you know, now looking back on it, that's a bit anti-Semitic because the guy, it's like anybody that, you know, people are always like, are you Adam Pally, Adam Scott, Paul Rudd? It's like, pick a Jew. I don't know.
Yeah.
And I got lucky and I did it right. And Ang, God bless him, liked my performance. And then I booked that. And then the industry kind of like, they announced it in Variety or whatever. And like the industry was kind of like, whoa, cool. And put it on my IMDb. And I remember that being like a big deal. Yeah, it was like a big deal for me, you know, and went to the like, took my girlfriend to the premiere, got edited out pretty much. But it was like, you
that's
know,
tough.
It's tough stuff. But like, I'm in there. I have a line or two of close up, you know, I have a good credit, really nice credit. But like that. So that was my first thing, really. And then I think after that, things just started. It wasn't like an avalanche of work, but things just started like going.
Were you doing the whole pilot season thing for a while?
Not really. I had been lucky enough to create some content early on, comedically, even before booking that movie, that kept me employed and paid and like a roof over my head. And so that was kind of like enough for me, you know, at that point. And I was like performing every night, literally every night. So it was like, that was fine. That was like kind of all I was like looking for. And then one of those projects, like I needed to pitch out in LA and I did. And I auditioned for, I guess I auditioned for Community for the Russos and I got really close and they were like, oh, you got to be here for pilot season. And
which part on Community?
It was Community had already been on the air for a year. So it was
it was just like a new character.
No, it was like a date. It was like a three line thing,
Yeah.
But I was like improvising. And then they were, and that was such a faith, like even the casting directors and everybody were like, you should stick around. And I remember calling home and being like, hey, I think I need to like go out to LA. And I went out to LA and then pretty soon after that, I booked Happy Endings. But they had seen me for a couple shows already. And Jamie Tarsus, who's a legend, had seen me the previous year and had seen, I guess was aware of me. So it was like, I was building somewhat, you know, it was a slow build. I wasn't the type of person that was just like, boom, you're on TV, you know? But that's okay. That's good. I value that now looking back.
Yeah. I mean, Happy Endings is just such a beloved show in a lot of ways. And then I think it did okay when it was on the air and sort of like Champagne Hill. Now it's on Netflix. And I was wondering if you're sort of hearing more from people who are seeing it for the first time on Netflix, because that's sort of a phenomenon that keeps happening with shows that existed and people think they're like new Netflix shows.
Yeah, a little bit. Sure. Yeah, it happens. You know, I think, again, even a show like that, like there's so much good stuff out there. There's a wealth of good stuff. Like it's almost like there's a show per person.
It does feel like that. There are shows that I'm like, I'm pretty sure they made this just for me.
Yeah, Like, there is. There's like a show for dudes with a Steen last name with a beard.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, pump those out, get those algorithms working. You know, they're like, this guy loves the glass blowing show on Netflix. Like, more of that. You know, but yeah, like, they're so even now, like, I wouldn't say there's like an onslaught of people being like, oh my God, I didn't know you were on television.
It's funny. I was looking back at sort of the coverage of Happy Endings, interviews with you when it came out. And the big theme is just how progressive your character was, because he was gay without being stereotypical.
Well, it's official. I am retiring from gay. That's right. I'm straight now. From this moment forward, it's going to be a steady diet of boobs and dudes. Damn it. I am no longer interested in men. I am only interested in men. Come on. From this moment forward, it will be a steady diet of chicks with... Damn it. I love guys. My favorite thing to touch is the penis.
Okay, what happened?
I went to a gay bar last night and nobody spoke to me. Not even a whiff.
Let me guess the name of the bar. This is So Fun Manhole. Backdoor. Club Tush. Dream Balls. Club Tush again. Is it Club Tush?
It was Greg's, Jane. The gay bar was called Greg's.
And I was just curious how you think that's aged, because now I think there's a lot more of like, should straight people even play gay characters on TV and that question. So did you think about it, or do you think about it any differently now than you did then when it came out?
Sure. Yeah, of course I think about it differently. You know, it's an interesting one because like I really love playing that character, and like if they rebooted Happy Endings, I would be heartbroken if someone else was playing that character. Like I would be gutted. But I'm sure at the same time, when the character was first created, there was someone more realistically like Max who, when the part went to me, was equally gutted. And so I don't know what the right answer is, but I do know that we made the show with the best intent. And whether that, looking back on it now, has held up, I don't want to sound like I'm like defensive. Like, I'm sure there's things that we could do differently.
Yeah, I think that's true for any comedy, you know, that's a decade old or whatever it is. You know, it's like there are things evolve.
Sure. But I am proud of that character. I'm proud of the context of the show still. And I think that like time moves so quick that it's like, there is a slight, like, at the time there was nothing like that, truly, you know? And so, I mean, in that level, and there were people before, like, you know, Steve Agee and Brian Posehn, those guys, they did it similarly before,
Sarah Silverman at that show.
Yeah, but that was almost a gimmick based on how quirky they were. You know what I mean?
It was kind of a joke, like, whereas the joke was not that your character was gay and
And I think had we got to go further, I think there would have been a lot more opportunities for me to play a more well-rounded version of that character, but such is life.
Yeah. You did do a little reunion on Zoom during the pandemic with everybody, right? How was that to kind of recreate the show in that sense?
Great. It's so fun. I mean, I love those people. I love those, like, you know, I talk to Casey every day, which is, the best. And you know, I'm still working with David Casp. Champagne Ale is David Casp. My next show is David Casp. You know, try to keep it in the family.
What's the next show?
I can't really talk about it yet. Okay. But but it's with David.
So it'll probably
I keep it in the family. I.e. no one else will work with me. No, I'm just kidding. I'm very sought after.
Coming up, Adam explains how he knew that Late Late Show gig was going to be a big deal, and talks about how he ended up playing Donald Trump Jr. on The President Show.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet Plush Care, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're enjoying this episode and want to hear more, please make sure you are following The Last Laugh wherever you get your podcasts. So you can check out our episodes with Adam Pally's late night sidekick Ben Schwartz and The President Show star Anthony Attamanik. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to Adam Pally. Sort of going back to UCB stuff, I had Ben Schwartz on this podcast almost 2 years ago, and we, you know, I made him talk to me for too long about the Late Late Show experience, which is just one of my favorite things ever. And it's so strange to me that it's kind of like disappeared from the internet almost. Like there are clips of it.
Still? Is it still?
I mean, there are like clips of it on YouTube, but you can't really see the whole thing. And it's this like, it's just become a sort of like more and more legendary as time goes on, I think. So I would love to just, since I talked to him about it, to hear a little bit about it from your perspective. And, you know, for anyone who doesn't know, this is you guest hosted the Late Late Show in that time before James Corden was going to start. And it just, you had Ben Schwartz as your sidekick. It was in the middle of a blizzard in New York, right? In the CBS This Morning studio, which was an odd choice by somebody.
Yeah, I don't think it was a choice. I think it was a necessity. I honestly think it was like a contractual thing that was being like covered up or something. It was like something wasn't ready. Someone wasn't ready. You know, it was like Ferguson left early or something. Like something wasn't right. Yeah. Which is always an odd to me in like television when they're like, it's not ready. Like, what do you mean? You've known this was going on for like legit years.
I also thought it was so funny that there was no audience, which in this weird way predicted what late night TV has been for the past, you know, year and a half, where everyone's doing it, right? You were there
no,
first.
No, totally. Oh, no, I would never say that. But I definitely knew what it felt like to have no audience. But like, I think again, like I know what that feels like from being on stage, you know, and like part of comedy, I feel like, is like the adapting and then surprising people with how you're going to react to this new thing, right? Like a comic could have a perfect hour set that they've crafted for years and years and years, and they get to the stage, and no matter how good the freaking jokes are, one heckler screams out, "I love you," and the comic goes, "Thanks, Dad," and the audience is like, "I didn't expect that to happen." You know,
yeah, it's
like
just the surprise factor.
The surprise factor is like horror. That's why they're so close together. It's like the surprise of it. So I think part of that was what made the Late Show so good, that when we hosted, was like people hadn't seen what it was like to have a joke like truly bomb.
Yeah. You don't get to see that too much on TV.
Yeah. And I think luckily then the surprise is like you think the host is going to sweat when the stuff starts not going well. But because Ben and I done so much of that, and we just powered through, and like part of it was like we knew that was going to be the case, and the other part was just like truly having a good time no matter what.
That's what I was going to ask. Did you know before you started filming that it was going to be as big of a sort of train wreck as it ended up being?
It was. I was getting, as soon as I got on the as soon as I got to the plane ticket, I could tell kind of what was happening. You know what I mean? Like, I was like, oh, why do I have to go to, first I was like, I'm in Los Angeles, why do I have to go to New York? They were like, that's where they're filming. Do you want it or not? This is the last slot on a Friday night in January. And I was like, no, I want it.
Did someone drop out, or do you think what happened?
Honestly, I think they were I don't think they knew how long they were going to be without one or the other, and they were scrambling. Like, my week was kind of crazy too, if you go back and like look at the tape, because I believe it was like Whitney Cummings was on the flight with me, and I remember us both bitching about how shitty this was. But Regis Philbin did two nights, I believe, and one of his guests was Donald Trump, and I met Donald Trump.
And this was like,
jarring. I have a picture.
This was sort of like, 9 months maybe before, 7 months before he announced the campaign.
Yeah, the world was a way better place. Like, it was not.
What was meeting him in that context like?
Cold. Like, I was trying to do a bit and he didn't want to do it. And then it was over. And I think that was a Tuesday. So that was the first day I was in the studio and I was trying to get my equipment out because I wanted to do some pre-tape stuff. And they were like, oh no, you don't have any equipment. I was like, what? And they're like, yeah, this is all like props, like in this news department. It's all fake. There's no you can't use these microphones. Like, what? And luckily my friend, Sam, who had been a producer for NBC Golf, he had some equipment and we scrounged it together. We grabbed a thing and went out and, just did what you could. But I feel like, again, that's Ben. I don't know if Ben told you this story, but when Ben and I used to work at the UCB, Ben was a bartender and I was an intern. It was Friday nights. And this is a long one. It's 2003. It was almost 20 years ago. We would clean up after the last show. We'd watch all the shows little kids with our eyes open, just watching these amazing comedians do stuff. And we clean up the whole theater back to front, throw everything away. And then because there would be no one in the theater, we would get on stage and just make each other laugh. And if there was another intern cleaning up, or if there was someone working the booth or whatever. And looking back on it, it was a really romantic time because, our buddy Gil would drive in, who's now one of the head writers on Big Mouth. And it would just be I don't know, there's no audience. So you're just, the three of you are just performing for each other. You're doing it
because you want to be doing it.
Yeah. And it's 5 a.m. on a Friday night in Chelsea.
You wanted to bring that energy to the Late Late Show.
Yeah, we did. We were just what if it isn't really being taped and it's just us in here right now doing this for ourselves?
Say something funny and we'll drink at the same time.
Oh, all right.
Go to one of your classes.
Okay, I'm guest hosting the Late Late Show.
Oh.
Yeah. Terrific.
Let's push through this part.
There are going to be peaks and valleys of all of this.
It's going to be a big valley.
It's not all going to be great.
We're mostly going to stay, live in a plateau and valley for a while.
America, when I took this gig...
Stop talking like all of America is listening. For a moment, realize what your demo is and how many people are watching this show. Before you blanket the entire country that is watching you.
There's only, two 16-year-old Filipino chicks watching
this. Yeah, say, parts of New Jersey, may I talk to you for a moment?
Let's talk to who's really watching. Dad...
It wasn't live, right? I mean,
it was not live. No.
Were you surprised that it actually aired after you taped it?
No, I knew it was going to air. I knew we were doing something special too. The producer, Nick Bernstein, who still produces for James Corden, he's the one. I don't know if you've watched Corden lately, but he's on air now. He has super long hair. They've made him grow his hair super long since the pandemic. He's kind of a legend of late night, actually. And he was my producer on it, and I had met him early on. He was one of the first champions of me even auditioning for SNL. He found me when I was really young at the theater doing just what I was doing. And so he was my producer on it, and he kind of felt after the first 5 minutes, he's like, this is something special. And so he kept pushing us to keep going further and further. And so I when we were done, he was like, I don't know what that was, but I really enjoyed it. And I was like, oh, okay. I enjoyed it too. And then it was what it was.
Yeah. I love that the very last thing that happens is that you say you think you just blacked out. But what was going through your head either during or right after it ended? Were you happy with what you guys had done?
Yeah. I tend not to think about it. Like, I've had too many, getting cut out of that Ang Lee film was a good life lesson. Like, I've had too many, things go too many ways to ever feel like, oh, that's going to be great. You just don't. And so truly you can only, I was happy because I had fun doing it during the time. And then after I was like, no one will see it. I kind of just went about my day. I think I flew to my friend. I think I went to Rachel Bloom's wedding the next day.
And then did you start hearing from people who had seen it, or what was the fallout from it, either positive or negative? Yeah.
I started getting texted from people like during it, and they were like, what is going on? And that's when I was like, oh, I did something good. Because like, you know, like when a friend from, especially a comedian friend, texts you, it means that something you did like made an impact, because we're usually a very jealous, callous group of people.
There's a high bar if we see something
we like, we will keep it to ourselves. You know what I mean? We're not going to run around praising shit. So if you get a text from a comedian friend or like one that's not throwing them out there that much, you're like, oh, I think I did something good.
It seems like you've always had an interest in late night talk shows, given your appearances on, you know, Conan and sort of the long running bits that you've done on some of these shows. Do you put a lot of thought into how you come across on these shows and how you think about it?
Not as much how I come across.
Or just...
My publicist is probably like, he should. Yeah. not as much how I come across. You know, like, I came up at a different time, and my heroes would often, you know, like, I would stay up. If I heard Robin Williams was going to be on The Tonight Show, I would stay up late to watch him. Or like if I heard even like Bruce Willis used to do crazy funny bits with Letterman. And if Bruce Willis was going to be on Letterman promoting, you know, whatever movie, I would be like, yeah, I'm going to stay up late to watch that. And it was almost more fun for me than the movie. See what stupid hat he was wearing with the logo of the movie on it. You know, like one time he rode in on a bus, you know. And then, you know, you mix that with like Jim Carrey. And a lot of his bits, especially like after his Andy Kaufman stuff and Andy Kaufman, Steve Martin, you know, Dave Chappelle, even on that. I mean, that's not cool to say right now. Oh, old Dave Chappelle.
not 2021 Dave Chappelle.
but the way that Dave would like, you know, I don't know, where you'd be like, is this real? Is this not real? Like, I always really loved that. Always really loved, like, you know, that energy that he had when he would go on Letterman or whatever. So when I started to be involved in that circuit, I would take a lot of pride and I tried my hardest like to keep to do something every time.
Yeah, and topping yourself too. I mean, with the Conan costumes, it seemed like they only got more elaborate every time you would go on.
Yes, that is a bit. Yes, heightening that bit was a prison I created for myself.
is there one that stands out to you in terms of just how it went or that you felt particularly proud of?
I like them all. I like each one is a different song. You know, different track from an album.
Yeah,
but they're all by the same band, yeah, so you kind of know how they go.
The Fat Batman and just with Jeff Garland being there and the whole dynamic, I think that one works pretty well. He's taking pictures
Jeff's
of you.
Yeah, a sweetheart. Yeah, he's a sweetheart guy. Never got those really pictures.
Oh man, maybe you'll see him someday. yeah, and then there's the President Show, which is also sort of like a talk show parody in a way. And it's just one of my favorite things from the past several years. I think it's really sort of the most successful Trump related content that was put out during that whole time. And I've talked to Anthony Atamanik a lot about it. How did you get involved in that? Cause you were a producer, executive producer on the show.
Yeah. I helped create the show with Anthony. Anthony and I go way, way back. We improvised together at UCB for forever. And early on, when I had first seen his Trump, it was so good. And, you know, it was so good, but it wasn't just the impression that was so good. It was the content was so good. You know, he was able to, like, really channel that kind of freewheeling, you know, kind of anarchic, I'll say anything at any time. You know, he really is able to do that and improvise like Trump too. And you know, part of Trump's whole thing was being on television every day. And there was a certain, you know, when we were first conceiving, it was like, we could do a news network. We could do fireside chats. We could do like,
yeah, but there are a million different ways to do it.
Yeah. But Trump would never do that. He would do the biggest, most ostentatious thing ever. And, you know, aside from the president, having a late night talk show is one of those jobs that there's no way you don't come out of it like a little fucked up. You know, to have a whole thing like that that revolves around you 365 every day with no jeopardy of your job changing. And it's just like applause, 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 applause. It fucks with it. There's no way it doesn't mess you up.
Did you, working on that show, did you sort of follow the way that other comedy shows were handling Trump, whether it was SNL or the other late night shows? And did you, you know, think about how you guys wanted to do it differently?
It was hard not to follow them, especially with like Alec at the time, I think was like a little bit like get off my lawn, you know, with us.
They had a little beef. Fine.
Yeah, which is fine. I love them both. Obviously my allegiance is to Anthony, unless Alec has a job for me. No, I'm just kidding. But I think we tried to do our own thing. And again, like the producers on that show, I've been so lucky, really like super, super fortunate in my career to work with some of the best writers and creators and producers ever in the history of the world. And like, when you look at the Happy Endings writer's room, like 90% of those writers went on to showrun, produce their own shows. And then that, I've been just lucky enough to like be around similar things. And the present show was just like kind of a similar thing in that writer's room. Like all those writers, whether it's Ray Sunny, Mitra Juhari, Noah Garfinkel, Allison Leiby, Christina Nangle, Pete Gross, like Neil Casey, John Gemberling, like you're like, those, all those people have gone on to become such like forces in the industry that the show at the time had no choice but to have like a crackling energy, you know?
Whose idea was it for you to play Donald Trump Jr.?
That was Nangle. That was Nangang. Yeah. I don't know.
How did you feel about the casting?
I liked it. You know, at first I was a little bit like, I don't know, like, cause we weren't even going to do any other Trumps, you know, we were like trying to stay away from it a little, like we never did Ivanka or, you know, till the end, but they pitched it to me. And I remember I was driving back from a family vacation. I got a car alone with all the luggage, and I was like driving back, and Nangle called me early, and she's like, what do you think about playing Don Jr.? And we improvised together for like the whole car ride as Don Jr. And most of it was me in that voice, like asking if the place we were being interviewed in had a bathroom. And she kept being like, yes, it's downstairs. We're like, I walked downstairs. I didn't see a single bathroom. Like, she's like, you didn't look. And I was like, I did look. I saw a sign that said men. I don't want to go to the bathroom with other men. She's like, that's the men's room. It was like, and so like, we were like, oh, there's something here to making him like a mimbo kind of. And it worked. It worked out. It was really fun.
It's so funny because it's not even about health care. Repealing Obamacare is all about tax cuts for rich people like us. If we really cared about lowering health care costs, we'd move to a single-payer system so we could negotiate prices with providers.
God damn it, get back under the desk right now.
Plus, the whole thing with Obamacare was that a black guy told us to do it, and we did not like that. And then you said he was born in Kenya, but you knew.
No.
You knew he wasn't born in Kenya.
No, I did not.
And you only ran for president because you wanted to renegotiate The Apprentice.
Get them.
That the special that you guys did, the fall of Donald Trump, that sort of predicted the future, was one of the most incredible things.
We were very prescient. Yeah, we were able to predict a lot of cool stuff.
Yeah, it's so good. So as we get to the end here, I want to do our final segment, which is called The First Laugh. I'm going to ask you about some firsts in your career.
Yeah.
Let's start here. What's the first piece of comedy that you remember making you laugh really hard as a kid growing up?
First piece of comedy, like actual, like where you're like, I know you're watching it and you're like, I know this is comedic content. It's like a movie, like you want like a pop culture, like movie.
Yeah, movie or a stand-up or TV show.
I was young, but there was a VHS copy of Three Amigos that I eventually would like play so much. I like ran it, you know, when the tape would go down. And I remember two things from that movie, two bits, like making me just howl with laughter as a kid. And one is the Martin Short, My Little Buttercup, which is like the musical number where he's in the thing. He's like, my little buttercup. And then he starts doing it to the villagers. And he's like, and they're like, smile, smile. And he's like, yeah, they got it. And they all think that they're like, that it's just that movie's. And then there's another bit with the reading of the telegram, which always got me, where they go into like send a telegram. I remember, this is so old timey, but like the telegrams used to be like, I am at, you know, San Jose Station, stop. They do this bit in that movie with Chevy Chase where he's reading the thing. He keeps stopping and she has to do, she's like, more. He's like, right. He keeps reading. And I remember as a kid just being so delighted by that. And then there was another, this is more like crude, but I remember in Funny Farm, the Chevy Chase movie, he's eating these like meatballs at like the local diner. And there's like a funny line where it's like, those aren't meatballs, those are lamb's balls.
Yeah, I remember that.
And he like does this hilarious like take where he like spits them back up. I think those are my first two like laugh out loud things where I like, I saw myself, like, I was like, oh God, this is exciting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Do you remember the first time that you knew that you were funny?
I don't.
That's
okay.
Is
that weird? I don't really know the first time I was funny. You know, like I was not like a funny kid. I was funnier around adults. I was shy with people my own age. Really, really, really shy. I don't remember the first time I knew I was funny. I remember the first show I did, the first improv show I did, where like things clicked for me and I like understood what I was doing. And it was like super early on. It just felt like, you know, so much of improv and comedy in general is like, think you're just like thinking so much. You're just like, oh, I want to be funny. I want to write this joke. I want to be funny in the scene. You're like, oh, you're just like thinking about it. And so part of it is like, you can only get really good at it when you know it so well that you like let that go and you have it all. So it just like kicks in automatically. It's like, you're not even, it's like driving. You know, how do I get there? I drove there. Did you get in an accident? No, I'm an amazing driver. Like,
yeah. You and, know, I wasn't thinking about it once. Yeah.
I didn't think about it once. I didn't think, oh my God, I'm driving.
Yeah.
I just did it. You know, like, but so in order to do that, like you have to, you know, so I remember I did this bit. There's like this thing called a Herald, which is like and early on in improv culture, which is like, this is all so dated now. I don't even know if this exists anymore, but there was like a thing called Herald teams. Like you wanted to get on a Herald team because you got stage time. And I, while funny and energetic, I was not great. I did not really know what I was doing. And I could like get by like being funny and like, you know, but I was like not, didn't click. But I remember I did this one show and in the first, you got to do three beats and each beat you wanted to like make them funnier and funnier. And in the first beat, me and my scene partner played chickens and we were like nervous that the farmer was going to come grab us and cook us for the family. And we started like, you know, doing all this stuff, like barricading the coop and, you know, just all this stuff. And then the second beat of it, I came out and I made us like in Poland in the 40s. And we were like nervous that we were going to get snatched by the Nazis. And I remember like that thought, there's that, just that like small thought. And when I came out and did it, it got such a big laugh that we didn't even do the rest of the scene. Someone just like edited it because you knew.
You can get better than that. Yeah.
I mean, although I did look at my scene partner, was like, motherfucker, I'm about to fucking cook here,
yeah,
baby.
Yeah.
but you know, like what that thought, that like analogous thought, for me at a young age, it was probably like 23 or 24, I was like, oh, that's how you like do it with your mind a little bit. You like, it's just, and that, you know, and then the rest of the rules just kind of fall into the background and you just kind of start like intuitively doing stuff.
one credit that we didn't mention, which I believe was your first real TV role, was on Californication, where you're credited as young Hollywood douchebag. Mm-hmm. And I have to admit that I have not seen this episode, but what do you remember from that experience? And did you have any concerns about being typecast in that particular way?
I did find it funny. I was like, I had just moved to LA and I booked that part. I was like, really? But no, I booked that part from the great Beth McCarthy Miller, who directed those episodes. And she would later come on to, she's a 30 Rock director. She was at SNL for a while. And I had known her from New York and for a while. And she booked me in that part. And no, I did not really have any reservations about being typecast, though it would come to fruition. No, I was just so excited to work. So excited to work. And also, like, you know, seeing TV get produced like that, like, there's just TV, you got to move quick. Even if you're in cable, streaming, whatever, like, you're moving quick. Fucking move. And so anytime I was on set, I was like, oh my God, I guess to see how this thing works, you know?
Do you remember the first time that you met a comedy hero, or one time that you met someone who you really looked up to in the comedy world, and how it went?
I've met a lot of my I'm lucky enough to have met a lot of my comedy heroes. Sandler was a cool one. Sandler was a cool one. I've met him a couple times since, but the first time I met him, I got invited to a charity event we work a lot with the same people, but someone invited me to a charity event because Eddie Vedder was playing at this house in Malibu, and people know I love Pearl Jam, love Eddie Vedder. So I was like, yes, of course, I wanted to go. So I went, and it was kind of like a mixer. Like, you went and you hung out, and there was like a bunch of famous people there. It was like Judd Apatow and Jimmy Kimmel and Zach Galifianakis, like Kristen Wiig, like just a bunch of famous people, you know? And everyone like sits down, and the only person that I like kind of knew was David Spade. And so he was like, sit over here. So I like went and I sat down next to Spade, and Sandler came, and he sat like towards the end of the show, and he sat down next to me. And like, you know, for me, that's like, that's it. That's like, you know, that's the guy, that's the number one, you know? And like, I almost wanted to cry, but I was
you're
like,
watching
oh my God.
Eddie Vedder with Sandler
I'm
next to you.
Watching
must have been
Eddie play like an unplugged show over a sunset in Malibu. There's like 60 people here. I'm sitting next to David Spade and Adam
Sandler. Did you think you were dead, or?
I didn't know what to think. I was just like kind of there. And then Sandler turns to me and he's like, you like it when they, you like it when they cover the Who? And I was like, huh? What? Talking to me?
Yeah.
And he had his like arm in a sling. He had like messed up his arm playing basketball or something. He's like, Pearl Jam. He's like, you like it when Eddie covers the Who? And I was like, love it. And he's like, yeah, me too. And he goes, hey, check this out. Walks on stage, like from his seat. He just got up, walked on stage, and I was like, what is going on? And Eddie goes, ladies and gentlemen, Adam Sandler is going to join me. And then they played Baba O'Reilly. And I was like, whoa, what? That was cool. And he made it cool for me. You know, like he knew.
He gave you a little preview.
He gave me a little, he was feeling himself, and he gave me a little like, check this out. And I was like, I was there for it. And it was awesome.
That's hilarious. And then finally, I like to give comedians a chance to shout out other things that are making them laugh right now. So what's the last piece of comedy that made you laugh really hard? Something you've seen, someone you want to shout out who you really are enjoying right now?
Well, Tim Robinson's sketch show on Netflix, I Think You Should Leave, is pretty genius. Amber Ruffin is the best. I hope they give her The Tonight Show eventually. Not saying
that
you know,
would be cool,
but yeah, it would be cool. What else? Hacks is brilliant. Ted Lasso is good.
Another Sam Richardson jam.
Another Sam Richardson jammer. I wish I had more. You know, like I have three kids, and I'm like moving 40, turning 40, and like the most interesting thing I have is like a good interest rate.
that's good. That's important.
Yeah. Like there's nothing good or fun.
Not funny, but good. Yeah. Well, I hope you get more time to watch comedy when you are all moved into your new place.
Thank you. I won't, but thank you.
Well, thanks, Adam. This was really fun. I'm really glad we got to do it.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
All right. Thank you again to Adam Pally for being my guest on today's show. Champagne Ill is streaming now on Hulu, and if you missed it the first time around, I definitely recommend checking it out. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes and see who is coming up next week on the show. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.